I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. We live in a world of internet-based technology like social media, cloud storage, and instant messaging. We also live in the midst of a war with extremists, terrorism, and very real threats to our safety. In this hour of Midday, we're going to talk about the overlap of those two worlds. Sean Gallagher, the Baltimore-based IT editor of Ars Technica, joins us to talk about ISIS propaganda on social media and hacktivist Twitter accounts that aim to bring them down. Also, deck the halls with holly and drones. How did drones become one of this Christmas's most popular requests? And how much are we paying for them? Tech news on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad you're with us today. A little later this hour, we're going to follow up on a topic of a conversation I began last week. Drones are not appearing only in the sky, also on the holiday wish list of thousands of people, and the Federal Aviation Administration is scurrying to act on a proposal that owners of most drones be required to register their unmanned aerial vehicles with the federal government. But first, let's focus on the point where the war on terror meets the world we're more familiar with, the world of social media and instant messaging. Coverage of the terror attacks in Paris November 13th has brought into focus what many of us had not realized, how much of an overlap there is between those spheres of activity. There had been a fair amount of coverage of ISIS, the self-styled Islamic State, using social media to disseminate its message, to do recruiting. Who can forget the headlines from August a year ago when a video of the beheading of American photojournalist James Foley was posted to YouTube? More recent headlines have focused on the Islamic State's use of Twitter to recruit new followers and its use of the encrypted message app called Telegram. And now the question on the minds of many is, what should the companies behind these platforms do about it? Of course, this is your public radio, and Midday is your public forum, so we want to hear from you. You can call us at 410-662-8780. That's our local Midday phone number, 662-8780. 1-866-662-9309 is our toll-free long-distance number, and Midday at WIPR.org is our email address. We'd love to hear from you. With me in the studio to discuss the role that social media plays in this war on terror is Sean Gallagher. He's the Baltimore-based IT editor of the online magazine Ars Technica. He's a regular contributor to Midday's programs about technology. Sean, welcome back.
Thanks.
So catch us up. It's been widely reported that ISIS uses Twitter, YouTube, and other social media platforms. What is the primary way that they use them? Do they use them differently than you and I do?
Well, they use them the same way that you and I do, but they also use it to both coordinate and recruit people overseas. So they have a number of – there's a network of Twitter accounts that are associated with different operations of ISIS, or Daesh, as it's called, which allow them to send out materials to people – overseas to try and recruit them. A lot of it is propaganda material, images that are that we would find offensive usually, but often they're things that are they're trying to recruit people who are lone wolf type attackers and other people to operate on their behalf overseas. They also use encoded accounts where they use code words and things like that on Twitter to communicate with each other. They're also increasingly using a service called...
But let me just interrupt. When you say encoded accounts, this is a code of understanding among its followers, or is there actually something different in the message?
They use code words and other links to other accounts, and they use accounts that are disguised to look like they're not ISIS accounts as sort of blind drops for messages for people they want to reach out to. And these accounts are really difficult to distinguish from other accounts, from legitimate accounts, because they set up full profiles for them. with different geographic associations with them. But through looking at the patterns of how they communicate and who they follow and things like that, they actually have accounts that are set up purely to follow ISIS accounts, to promote the ISIS accounts and make them look like they have more followers than they actually have. Similar to something that, so there's, it's actually similar to some of the things that people in the marketing world do, where they buy Twitter followers to build up their credibility and their visibility online, because, you know, some people, you know, they look for how many followers somebody has to see if they're legitimate, for example. And there's a cash value associated often with the number of followers you have.
So is ISIS paying some of the its ill-gotten gains from taking over oil fields, et cetera?
Well,
is it
I don't think they're actually paying people to set up Twitter accounts for them. They have an IT team. They have a group of people who are technology people who work for ISIS, who work for Daesh, and go out and set up these accounts for them. And they have a pool of accounts set up that they can transfer to other people to use for other purposes. And they have account names that are set up specifically for various purposes associated with their operations. So the content of the accounts is, it seems to be, you know, fairly innocuous sometimes, but it's a lot of retweets and a lot of follows and things like that. But it's really a network of accounts that they use to communicate with each other and with potential followers to get them to join ISIS's cause. And in addition to Twitter, they also are they've used Facebook in the past. They've used YouTube in the past. They've also started using a service called Telegram, which you mentioned, which is a nonprofit, anonymized and encrypted social media platform that was developed by the founder of VKontakte, the Russian Facebook, essentially.
And let me ask you to explain both of those adjectives: anonymized and encrypted.
Right. So the accounts on Telegram, you only see people who you have in your address book.
Your personal address book for Telegram.
Right. So it's a mobile application. And you can also access your account from the web. But it's your account is associated with a telephone number, with a mobile device. And you only see the people who you have in your contact book as have direct communication with them. And that communication is encrypted, and it is passed through a number of different servers around the world. And so it's difficult for anyone to identify who the message is going to, and it's difficult to understand what your content is.
So that is not a recruitment tool. This is for a closed world.
There's another piece of this, though, which is a recruitment tool, and it's also a broadcasting tool. And they have a thing called channels on Telegram, which allows you to set up an open account associated with a specific name that you can put a web link to online, and people with a Telegram app can follow that channel. And they won't know who owns the channel. They just know that this channel is associated with a specific topic. And
something that they're interested in.
Right.
So they would,
and so ISIS has set up channels in the past, and this is public content, and has published not just, you know, little messages about what their mission is, but also you can also share files through this system. So they're able to share recruiting materials, instructions on bomb making, instructions on tactics and things like that with people online.
And that information is encrypted.
And that information is encrypted. Now, it's encrypted, but it's public. So anyone who's within Telegram can see it. So
anyone in Telegram.
Anyone in Telegram can see it. So if you find the URL, you find the web address to get to this channel, you can then see it. And what has happened is there are groups that monitor these channels. And Telegram is the nonprofit that runs Telegram has set up a group of people to monitor these things and to handle complaints about content being oriented towards a specific illegal activity or specifically terrorism or other criminal activities, and shuts those channels down. There are a couple of research groups that follow social media communications of ISIS and other groups, and they often feed information on these accounts to Telegram and to Twitter. Twitter actually has its own group within Twitter people who are native language speakers of Arabic and other Middle Eastern languages, Southeast Asian languages, so they can identify accounts and what they're talking about. So they have their own internal intelligence operation, essentially at Twitter, so they can shut down accounts that are associated with terrorist activity.
That's Sean Gallagher, IT editor of the online magazine Ars Technica, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Kast. We're talking about where social media and other apps intersect with the war on terror. There are a couple things I want to get straight. First of all, since the first time I heard about Telegram is in this context of something that was used in planning the terror attacks, I see it as this grim, dangerous thing. What was the origin of Telegram? What was it designed to do? And what would be an example of a good use of Telegram?
So Telegram is designed to allow people to communicate without being surveilled by the people around them, or by government agencies, or by criminals and other people who are out to get them, essentially. But so Telegram is designed as a chat application primarily. So, for example, if I want to have a conversation with a friend outside of the scope of normal social media, you know, Facebook collects data, Twitter, while it has direct messaging, it's an opaque situation. We don't know what happens to the data when we use it. We have conversations that could be eavesdropped on by the companies that run them. Telegram was set up specifically to be a not-for-profit operation by the founder of VKontakte, which, as I said, was sort of the Russian version of Facebook. He has a very specific political agenda, which is, I want everybody in the world to have free speech and not be squashed by governments. And while they are trying to regulate criminal and terrorist activity on their network, they specifically say that we do not sanction blocking any political speech. We want people to be able to have whatever conversations they want to have about their countries where they are, and protect that. It comes from the same world as the people who built Tor, an anonymized network that people use to browse the internet without being detected, where they having their location detected. Reporters use both of those services, so reporters might communicate with a source over Telegram who wants to be anonymous and not be detected by their employer or by the government. It's used by humanitarian organizations.
What kind of organizations?
Humanitarian organizations. Uh-huh. And non-governmental organizations to communicate because of concern that they're being monitored by governmental organizations who may not have their best interests at heart, both here and overseas. And it's also a way to get out of the whole advertising loop. So, for example, conversations you have in Google's Hangouts or via Gmail or on Facebook and things like that, that data, the conversations you have, who you have relationships with, is mined for use for advertising. And so one of the reasons why Telegram was set up was because they wanted to give people a social media platform they could communicate with each other on without having that data used as an advertising platform and essentially having you pay for the service
with
your profile. Right.
Yeah. So I read in the Washington Post the founder of Telegram, Pavel Durov,
right,
was asked, as I said, it was news to me after the Paris attacks, the use of Telegram by ISIS, but apparently experts like you have known about it. He was asked at a panel in September if he slept well at night, knowing his technology was used for violence. And he basically defended it. He said, I think that privacy, ultimately, and our right for privacy is more important than our fear of bad things happening like terrorism. If you look at ISIS, the Washington Post quotes Durov saying, if you look at ISIS, yes, there's a war going on in the Middle East. Ultimately, ISIS will find a way to communicate with its cells. And if any means doesn't feel secure to them, they'll find something else. We shouldn't feel guilty about it. We're still doing the right thing, protecting our users' privacy,
right.
Close quote. And yet, after the terror attacks, he did shut down some of the channels.
Right.
That-
but it's also important to remember that despite some of the earlier comments about encryption and these messaging services being used to coordinate the Paris attacks, there's no evidence of that. In fact, all of the communications that the terror cell in Paris used were unencrypted, and they used their own names. They didn't do it anonymously. They used regular phones, used SMS text messages. They didn't use anything that uses encryption or anything like that to hide their activities. And yet the government, the French government and the Belgian government, didn't detect these things in a way that they could act upon them. And so it's not an issue of them using encryption at this point. In that case, specifically, they were using everyday, unencrypted, unprotected communications that normal people use to do what they did, which was plan an attack and execute an attack and then start to plan a follow-up attack, which the French government then was able to intercept those messages. That's what led to the raid in Saint-Denis that got the mm-hmm. cell there.
Mm-hmm. Lots more to talk about here. I want to, when we come back after a short break, I want to ask you whether exactly what you were just talking about, using normal channels that millions of people use, is if there's any way to actually monitor that. But as I said, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Sean Gallagher, IT editor of Ars Technica, talking about the war on terror and social media. Should companies like Twitter use more resources to shut down the accounts of ISIS members? Should encrypted messaging services like Telegram have backdoor access to its private channels? What do you think? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're speaking about recent news regarding ISIS and social media and hacktivism with Sean Gallagher, based in Baltimore. Sean is IT editor of Ars Technica, and we welcome your thoughts, opinions, comments, questions. 410-662-8780 is our local number. Our long-distance number is 866-661-9309. And our email address is midday@wypr.org. So we'd love to hear from you on any of those platforms. Sean, I want to follow up on your point that that the people who planned the terror attacks in Paris, with what we know now, were not using specialized internet platforms to do it. And I just wonder whether that well, let me ask this first. You talked about Twitter monitoring. I mean, we've known for a long time about ISIS's use of Twitter, not necessarily for planning attacks, but for spreading its message.
Right.
What has Twitter done about that, if anything? What should it do about that?
Well, Twitter has a terms of use policy that enables it to shut down accounts that violate that terms of those terms of use, and those terms of use include using the account for anything illegal in the U.S. or overseas. And they have an abuse system where someone who sees an account that's doing something that violates terms of service or that's abusive in some way, they can flag that account and get Twitter to review it and shut it down. That's what the folks associated with one of the anonymous activist groups tried to use to shut down a bunch of ISIS accounts by essentially crowdsourcing, hunting down these accounts, and then using an application to automatically submit these accounts to Twitter's abuse.
Back up for us a second. What is Anonymous?
Anonymous is a group of a collective of individuals who use internet technology to go after specific political goals. It started off as a group that protested about the Church of Scientology's suppression of freedom of speech back in the 90s and in the early 2000s. And it became a hacktivist organization, and a hacker activist organization, where members of the group actually were coordinated bringing down websites through denial of service attacks and launched other what they call ops operations against specific targets for political reasons. They're sort of like the internet's version of the angry mob with pitchforks. but they're very, you know, they don't have a central leadership. There's a one point where they had a core group of people who were very talented hackers who went after specific organizations, including the United States government on a couple occasions, to do damage on the internet to those organizations. They hacked into this group called LulzSec, which was associated with Anonymous.
I didn't catch that.
LulzSec, LulzSec. So it's Lulz as in for the lulz, as in laughs.
Uh-oh.
Security, SEC. They went after Stratfor, a strategic intelligence company, hacked into their servers, got their customer database, credit card numbers, and things like that. And their leader, Hector Monsignor, who was known as Cebu, became an FBI informant after he was caught and turned on the rest of that group. And many of them got arrested. There are only one or two of them who are still at large. But outside of that, Anonymous as a group is largely people who join a chat channel and they see what the latest rage of the day is, and they decide to join in on it. And how can I get involved? And they have websites set up to show people which applications to install on their computer to use to do something, or how they can get involved in a particular operation. And after the Paris attacks, a number of these little operations, Op Paris and Op ISIS, started and tried to direct people to give them clues on how to find ISIS Twitter accounts. And then they had a website where you could download an application that you could run on your computer that would automatically submit abuse reports based on what they call sort of a hive mind. They build a page within a service called Pastebin that has a listing of all these accounts in it. It's all in text, and then they set up an IRC account. It's an internet relay chat account for a specific operation, and they keep posting the information. They post targets into this chat or into this board.
I mean, they basically, since Paris Anonymous, whoever is making it up, has claimed that they've shut down a whole, like,
right now, a number
a
of those
lot
accounts,
of ISIS accounts,
and a lot of those accounts are actually already shut down. They had been identified and already been shut down. Others may not have been ISIS accounts, and there's some confusion about which were and which weren't. The list that they got, the original list they got of accounts, was of questionable origin. And some of the accounts after, I actually reviewed some of the accounts they had on one of the target lists they published. And some of them were Palestinian accounts. Some of them were just normal Arabic accounts that didn't have anything to do with ISIS at all. They just happened to be in Arabic characters. The content used to, mm-hmm, was written, mm-hmm, in Arabic. Mm-hmm. Other parts of it, you know, some of them may have been involved with ISIS or may have simply retweeted some of the things that ISIS posted. They may have been sympathetic. That said, you know, we don't know how many actual ISIS-related accounts they actually shut down. Twitter said they were ignoring this flood of abuse reports that was coming from this campaign because there was a lot of errors, they said, in the data they were getting. So that's why they were relying on their own internal team to review accounts and find ISIS-related accounts and shut them down. And so some of the accounts that were shut down that were targeted by Anonymous may have been already targeted by Twitter and taken down. Others that they went after may not have had anything to do with ISIS or may have only been tangentially related to ISIS. So this is not uncommon on the internet. when you crowdsource going after somebody, I mean, if you think of some of the things that happened after, for example, the Boston bombing and then and some other terrorist attacks, there was an effort on Reddit, the social media site, that to crowdsource identifying the bombers from the photos from that people had taken from their
That's kind of scary.
And it was highly inaccurate, the result, and it turned out it ended up sending people off after the wrong people, not law enforcement, but there were people who were individually vigilante-wise going after people who they thought were involved in the attack, and they weren't, and they had to retrench and apologize. So,
well, is the scrutiny of Twitter, both by Twitter's own hierarchy, by its own within its own structure, and scrutiny from Anonymous and anybody else, I mean, is it your sense that they're making it enough of a hassle that ISIS will turn away
Twitter?
Or is it just something that every day there's a new account?
Well, let's add another layer to this, okay? The U.S. government doesn't want many of these accounts shut down because it's using them to monitor ISIS.
That is another
layer. So there's an intelligence gathering process going on here. So Twitter is a worldwide public conversation going on 24/7, and it is a stream of data that many organizations, both intelligence and commercial, pay to have channeled into their big data processing systems, into their giant computer systems, to figure out what's going on in the world based on patterns of communication.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that you post into Twitter is part of a large public feed, a large public data feed, a stream that can be processed selectively, geographically, or as a whole by thousands of programs running on computers that can look at the data and gather pieces out of it and relate them together. And NSA and the CIA and the FBI and many other international intelligence and law enforcement organizations use this data to get an idea of what's going on in the world. So when you hear about chatter and things like that,
that's chatter.
That's one part of chatter, is looking at what people are, what's going on Twitter accounts, what kind of communication is going on. And also, they monitor some of these Telegram channels as well, because these are public channels. In order for them to be able to work to reach people that these organizations want to reach, they have to be public. So they're monitored as well. So some of the accounts, in fact, you know, there was concern that some of the accounts that the Anonymous folks are going after were actually law enforcement accounts that were set up to troll, were set up to be honeypots for getting people to get them to follow who were interested in ISIS, so they could identify people within our country who might do that and then track them down. So there was a lot of crossfire there.
I don't know what you mean by crossfire.
Crossfire meaning, so you've got people trying to shut down accounts because they think they're doing the right thing, but those accounts are actually law enforcement accounts that are trying to get at the bad guys.
It's
they're shooting at the wrong people in a virtual way. As far as, you know, what Twitter does to shut down those accounts, it does what it needs to do by letter of the law. It's an international service. It's in the U.S. It acts under U.S. law. And when the U.S. government says shut down an account, they shut down an account. And the U.S. government is monitoring these channels just as well as Twitter is, in various ways. So, because it's a public service. Now, they're not monitoring necessarily direct messaging and things like that, but they are monitoring these public conversations.
That's Sean Gallagher, the IT editor of Ars Technica, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about, as you hear, we're talking about terrorist groups, their use of social media, what social media is doing to monitor that. I want to pull something else into this conversation, how technology itself can be used for harm rather than simply spreading a harmful message. A recent example is from last month when Facebook notified employees of the State Department about hacks by Iran. Of course, Iran is in the headlines again this morning, this being the 500th day that Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian has been held in custody. He's apparently been convicted in Iran of some kind of espionage charge, but Iran has been engaged in something called spear phishing against U.S. targets, and I was wondering whether you could bring us up to date on that.
So first, let's talk about what spear phishing is and what phishing is. So phishing is spelled P H I S H I N G. Right. So it's a technique used to trick people into responding to either a hyperlink, a web address sent to them in an email or posted them on social media to click on it, and that click leads them to a website that has malicious software on it that tries to put malware, either spyware or a virus onto your computer when you visit it. This is a technique that's been used in the criminal world for a while to do things like put ransomware on your computer and things like that. Spear phishing is a much more targeted attack on people that crafts messages to fool people by using information about them to make them think it's a legitimate document or web page. So, for example, a phishing attack might be might go out after millions of people and basically says...
Is this all the messages my Yahoo account gets that my account is too big and I need to click on this link
to get things right? That's exactly what it is.
That's just general phishing.
That's general phishing. So they'll send out something that, like, this is Apple, your account has been suspended, or PayPal, your account is being held right now. Click this link to enter your password, right?
Yeah, of course, enter your password.
So those are all phishing attacks that are designed to get at personal data, to get into your financial accounts or into your cloud accounts or in some cases to put malware in your computer. Spear phishing is targeted at individuals in a way that makes them believe that it's from a friend or a coworker, and it's about something that's specifically interesting to them. So, for example, a few years back, an email was sent out to people who were associated with the Tibetan government in exile and with other humanitarian organizations that were associated with Tibet. That was a document that was allegedly like the minutes of some upcoming conference on Tibet from an account that looked like it was a legitimate government account. And in fact, what it was a piece of malware that put spyware on all their computers. And the way that the message had been sent out was specifically tailored to be interesting to those people and make them believe that it was legitimate. That's one type of spear phishing. Another type of spear phishing is to use your friend's social media account or a coworker's social media account or a coworker's email account that has been compromised to send you something that includes information that is related to your ongoing relationship with that person and convince you that that's a legitimate document to open or a legitimate link to click. So sometimes Word documents or PDF documents can carry malware. If you don't have the most recent version of software, then there's a vulnerability in Word or in the PDF viewer.
So what was Iran doing when it was spear phishing?
So Iran went and it went specifically after junior people at the State Department, identifying them on Facebook, and then targeting their Facebook accounts to gain access to them. And they essentially compromised their Facebook accounts, gained control of their Facebook accounts, and sent messages to targeted individuals at the State Department who worked in departments related to Iran. So the Southwest Asian Center, you know, the areas of the State Department that deal with the area of Iran, the Iran interest group within the State Department, and also targeting people who dealt with issues surrounding dual citizenship. And they used those that targeting to gain access to the email accounts, the internal email accounts.
State Department
email accounts of those people, like compromising their computers and getting into their email. And it's believed that this was involved in Iran's arrest of a number of dual Iranian American citizens in Tehran.
When you say involved in the arrest, that information gleaned from these accounts,
yes,
was used as evidence?
Well, that information was used to identify people who were Iranian American citizens who the Iranians may have believed were working as spies. And there was an Iranian American businessman who was arrested shortly after this attack took place on the State Department, and they believe that this was the reason that they were able to identify this guy as being a dual citizen, because he traveled in an Iranian passport to Iran. He didn't take his American passport, but they were able to identify him as being a dual citizen.
And the thought is that they were able to identify him because they had been basically co-opting these emails inside,
right,
State Department,
yes,
email. Why is Iran doing this more now? I mean,
this is
new, right?
Or this is new-ish. So Iran has done a number of – there have been a number of cyber attacks that have been attributed to Iran. And some of them have been very low-level type things. Most of them have been fairly destructive in how they've gone after things. So, for example, there was an attack on Saudi Aramco and some other oil companies a few years back where a virus got put onto systems and destroyed the data on their hard drives, wiping data off of most of the network, similar to what happened in North Korea, in South Korea a year or two ago. And then they've also gone after financial organizations' websites. There was a hack of JPMorgan Chase's web server, for example, that was purely destructive, and there were some attempts at financial attacks. But those were pretty run-of-the-mill stuff when it comes down to it. I mean, some of these were fairly sophisticated in terms of what they achieved, but they used basic tools that, you know, I mean, there was one attack that was on the Sands Casino that used a program written in Visual Basic, which is a very common programming language. And it was basically, you know, something that a couple of computer science students could have done by doing some social engineering and finding out who an administrator was. And they gained access to this guy's account and got in and took over his account and used it to get into the network and distribute the software and erase all the hard drives in the network at the Sands Casino. So that's the sort of thing they've been doing in the past. They're purely like, you know, blunt force attacks,
mm-hmm,
from a cyber perspective. This is much more subtle. This is intelligence gathering. And this is, in some ways, it's believed this is because Iran wants to show that it is sophisticated enough to use cyber attacks in a way that would sort of make up for the fact they just signed this treaty saying that they signed this agreement that they were going to dismantle their nuclear program.
Oh, really? We think,
yes,
there's some compensating.
They're showing that, you know, they're not, you know, just because they made nice with us over this nuclear agreement does not mean that they are our friends. They are going to continue to go after us, and this tool is in their toolkit. And part of the reason why they are so caught up on using cyber attacks is because we used it on them. The Stuxnet malware,
uh-huh,
that was developed, was believed to be developed by NSA and the Israelis, was used to basically go in and disable the centrifuges in Iran's nuclear research facilities.
Uh-huh.
That was a cyber attack against Iran, and it had fairly wide ranging consequences for Iran. And there were other attacks that were mounted on Iran's internet infrastructure and on their information infrastructure that have been attributed to state actors against Iran. So Iran has an interest in showing that it, too, can play that game, that it can go out and go after the United States government in the same way.
So they kind of wanted us to see that they'd done this.
I believe so. Now, the thing is that it was not, this whole attack was not discovered until Facebook alerted the users whose accounts had been attacked, saying you have been your account's been compromised by a state actor.
Interesting thought. Wait, let's hold that thought. We need to take another break here. When we return with Sean Gallagher, the IT editor of Ars Technica, we'll wrap this up. And also, we'll talk about drones. So you want to be part of that, you can call us at 416-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Our guest this hour is Sean Gallagher, based in Baltimore, the IT editor of Ars Technica. He knows technology in and out, and we've been talking about some pretty heavy topics this hour. So I'd like to turn our conversation to one that might be a little bit lighter, and that is unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, or commonly called drones. They've sort of become all the rage, appearing on holiday lists across the country. According to the Consumer Technology Association, 400,000 drones are expected to be sold this holiday season in the U.S. And now the Federal Aviation Administration is proposing new rules for recreational drone use. Sean Gallagher, tell us what the FAA is aiming to do and why.
Well, the reason that they want to regulate these is that there's a lot of concern about how drones are used, especially around airports. There have been a number of incidents recently over the past year or two where small drones have been flown close to the approaches to airports, where airline pilots have seen drones out their window and they've been close calls. They've been afraid that they were going to hit them. And even though drones are small, most of these don't weigh more than about a pound. The impact of one of those hitting a windshield or hitting a jet intake, for example, on an aircraft, could be catastrophic. It could cause an aircraft to lose power to an engine, could cause, it's like what happened with the U.S. Airways flight in New York when it hit geese.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to perform the emergency landing in the Hudson River. You don't know what's going to happen when something hits you at the relative speeds that airplanes travel at. So there was concern that there would be mid-air collisions between these unlicensed hobbyist drones and aircraft because people were operating them in places where they weren't supposed to. Then there was the incident with the drone crashing on the White House lawn.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of.
And there's the concern that these things will get used for nefarious purposes. And drones, unlike model aircraft, like normal model aircraft, can fly out of line of sight. You can send them along a guided path based on GPS to go someplace and fly a route without you having direct control over it. So it's easier to fly in many cases. The more expensive ones fly pretty much on their own. You just tell them where to go.
And so I could be telling my drone where to go, and I might have no idea that path that I've just outlined for my drone is going to cross near an airplane.
Yeah. Because
I no longer have control
right.
over it.
Well, you have some control over it. Depends on how you're controlling it. But in some of these cases, these drones were just flying on a specific GPS path or something like that, and they were well out of visual view of the operator. And that's what drones can do. They can fly autonomously to some degree. That's what makes a drone different than a model aircraft. So I've got something that somebody might call a drone. It's a quadricopter, but it's not a drone because it doesn't fly autonomously. It flies with a remote control, and I have to be able to see where it is. Drones can fly, where you tell them to by giving them waypoints, by clicking on a tablet application or something like that, giving GPS locations to fly to, and basically laying in a course for them to fly. And you don't have to be involved in it once you send them off on their way. You can recall it. You can watch a video from it. You can have some control over it. But drones, as they're being introduced to the consumer market, the ones that are more autonomous, they fly on their own, and they can fly out of line of sight. And that's the big concern that the FAA has. They don't want these things to fly out of line of sight. They want operators to always be able to control them. And also they're talking about now having everyone who buys a drone register it with the FAA so that if it is involved in an accident of some sort, they can track down who owned it.
And, I mean, I can imagine why the government would like to be able to do that, but that's not preventive. That's after the fact.
That's after the fact. But also, if you're registering a drone, you have to go through a registration process. That's not quite the same thing as getting a pilot's license.
I was going to say, what would be involved in this registration?
That hasn't been clarified yet. So it may be at the point when you buy something, you have to show a photo ID and you have to register with the FAA who you are and what you're doing with it. So if it's a concern, and then you're going to have to follow specific guidelines that the FAA publishes on how to operate it,
like filing a flight plan?
You won't have to file a flight plan if you're operating in specific areas and the drone is under a certain weight. But one of the reasons why drones have not become as widely used as they might be yet is that the big concern that the FAA has is that commercial organizations and state and local governments and other people flying drones long distances to do things like, for example, Amazon delivering packages.
For example.
They're concerned that once there are all of these things up in the air, that there will be no
literally.
Way. That there will be no way for them to detect each other or other things in the air and avoid collisions and things like that. So they're going through a very lengthy review process to try and get people to come up with ways to both do collision avoidance and especially for larger drones. Make sure that they do, in some cases, file flight plans because they're actually asking for people to be trained operators, certified operators for drones over a certain size.
Do you have a sense of what kind of prices we're talking about for people to become part of this drone nation?
Right now, it's probably $400 and up for the more autonomous ones.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to do something with just playing around with a quadricopter that is simply a radio remote controlled, essentially model airplane, they're much cheaper than that. But the prices will come down because the technology that's at the base of them is very simple technology. So, you know, within a year or two, once mass markets are opened up for these things, there have been a number of drones that have been on the market for a while. DJI has the Phantom line, for example. Those drones run like $600, $700 now, I believe.
And you expect they'd get
cheaper? I expect that once there's competition in the market, once the FAA has clarified what its rules on these things are, that they're going to get cheaper. Also, there will be larger ones and special purpose ones that come into the market. One of the industries that is really excited about drones is the movie making industry, because you can put a camera on a drone much less expensively than you can put it in a helicopter. And if you think of all the helicopter shots
you see in
movies,
yeah.
And you think of all of the cinematography that is enabled by booms and helicopter shots and things like that, the movie industry is thrilled by the idea of being allowed to get robots with cameras on them in the air. So
we're flat out of time. Sean, what's the timeline for the FAA to make its next decision on this? Do you know?
They're in the rules gathering process at this point. They're supposed to have something out in the next year or so.
Okay. I appreciate your catching us up on it. And thank you for this whole conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Sean Gallagher, IT editor for the online magazine Ars Technica. And thanks to you, our listeners. I also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features sandwiches and salads and specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. We'll be back tomorrow. Hope you'll join us then. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for being here today.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. Midday's intern is Adam Dronberg. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.